Justice is bringing about genuinely good lives for people with good, fairly distributed cross persons. I'm just going to walk through this, the slides. This needs clarification, but it looks to be a plausible version of act consequentialism, namely, one ought always to do whatever would bring about the best reachable outcome impartially assessed. Justice here is just, it's just a name for fundamental, enforceable moral principles. Act consequentialism also strikes me as plausible, but to understate the point, it's controversial. So, in an ecumenical spirit, here's a non-consequentialist view. Justice is bringing about good lives for people with good fairly distributed while respecting people's legitimate freedom to live as they choose and their rights not to be wrongfully harmed or denied benefits in certain ways. This view differs from consequentialism. It accepts constraints and options. Constraints, one is not always morally permitted to do, what would bring about the best outcome? Sometimes one ought to refrain from wronging another person, even when that doing so would bring about the best. Options, one's not always morally required to do what would bring about the best. Each person is morally at liberty to some degree to live as she chooses, pursuing her own projects. The two proposals share features. One is that morality includes a significant beneficence requirement, a duty to bring out better states of affairs. Another is welfarism. Insofar as morality demands that we bring about better states of affairs, what makes a state of affairs better is increasing the welfare of persons or more fairly distributing it. Welfare, just individual well-being, what in itself makes a person's life go better for that very person. Welfare is prudential good, what a person aims at insofar as she's being prudent. One might have rational aims other than prudential good. You might seek the prudential good of others or seek conformity to moral norms. A life might be good along other dimensions, aesthetically exemplary, for example. It might, your life might be a terrific story from rags, aesthetically pleasing, from rags to riches or riches to rags, without being high in welfare. A further possibility is that insofar as morality demands that we avoid wronging persons, violating directed duties towards them, wronging consists either in mistreating the person in a way that wrongfully harms her or fails to benefit her. Harm and benefit being understood as welfare, gains and losses. Welfarism should allow that the welfare of persons that are person-like to some degree should also determines what we ought to do. We just ignore this complication in animal rights. So to give welfarism a fair hearing, one must conjoin the idea with the most plausible available conception of what in itself makes someone's life go better for her. So I try to keep that just a blank check. Just fill in what you think is the best view. So here's a strong welfarist doctrine. The good is defined independently of the morally right, and two, what's morally right is maximizing the good. The weaker version under review here holds one, that's just an assumption, and also holds that what's morally right is to maximize some function of the good, but the function incorporates independent moral right factors, the ones that together define fair distribution. In its non-consequentialist version, welfarism allows that whether harming someone is wronging depends on moral right factors independent of welfare. So for example, harmful lying might be wrongful harming, whereas harmful truth-telling is not wrongful harming. So weak welfarism, that's the wimpy claim. The view to be defended here is still weaker. In its consequentialist guise, welfarism could insist that to determine fair distribution, the only information needed is a list of the persons who might be affected by your action, with each person paired with the lifetime well-being towards which she's heading, absent the impact of the act under review, plus a statement of the correct fair distribution principle. This could be maximize aggregate welfare summed across persons, maximize the average, equalize at the highest possible level, maximax, bring about sufficient well-being for all, prioritize, or something else altogether. We need something still weaker. Suppose you're choosing between two actions or policies whose outcomes in fair distribution of welfare terms, as just described, are identical. In one outcome, the virtuous, the truly deserving, fare much better than the non-virtuous, the truly non-deserving. And in the other, the reverse is true. Leave the specification of what makes someone deserving as a blank to be filled in, except I want to insist deservingness is going to be moral praiseworthiness, and its measure is adjusted so far as possible to eliminate moral luck. Beyond that, we have to say more. If we balk at indifference between the outcomes, where the saints do well and the sinners badly and the reverse, and prefer to some degree that saints fare better than sinners, we're registering commitment to deservingness as a partial determiner of fair distribution. In this case, to determine fair distribution, you need further information about each person's deserving the score, as well as information about the lifetime well-being towards which she's now headed. An individual's being deserving increases the moral value about bringing about well-being gains for her. So now add the assumption that individual actions and public policies can affect the degree to which persons become deserving. I actually doubt this is conceptually possible, but just assume this is so. These acts might have zero effect on the production or distribution of welfare, but bring it about that the welfare gains of those with enhanced deservingness have somewhat greater moral value. Your act, according to weak welfareism, can have a point, there can be reason to reform it, even if for sure the act will have no impact on who gets how much welfare, and even if the act reduces some people's well-being without increasing anyone else's. The extreme, depending on the numbers, the weak welfareist view could endorse a policy that lowers the lifetime well-being of every person on earth, but compensates by bringing it about that some people are more deserving. The best reachable state of the world is the one in which deservingness weighted well-being adjusted to reflect other fair distribution factors is maximized. So, mutatis mutandis, a non-consequentialist version of weak welfareism will also accommodate a deservingness concern. That's obvious, I think, that you can do that. To clarify, in affirming deservingness, I don't intend to take any stand on free will and moral responsibility issues. Maybe moral responsibility is never instantiated. The assertion here just is conditional. If either human choices are not caused events or their being caused events is compatible with moral responsibility, then it's going to be morally better to some degree that welfare gains go to saints, truly deserving individuals. Also, another caveat, the position as stated takes no stand on the comparative moral importance of bringing about welfare gains for the more deserving, as opposed to bringing about larger rather than smaller gains for whoever benefits. In its non-consequentialist version, weak welfareism incorporates constraints and options. And here, we want to hold open the possibility that violation of a constraint might require wrongful harming or wrongful failure to benefit in welfare terms. In its further weakened version, the welfareist condition has to be relaxed to allow that corruption of character, making somebody less deserving, might violate a moral constraint without having any positive impact on anyone's welfare. And then options and the duty of beneficence are mutually dampening. The duty of beneficence limits but does not eliminate options. So I'm just going to throw in, to give the view slightly more structure, maybe make it more tractable for discussion, three initial stipulations. No difference, we're not going to be able to sustain this one, aggregation and moralities having more multi-level structure. This is for either, take either the consequentialist or the non-consequentialist version. No difference says that if doing one act rather than another makes no difference to anyone's welfare or character, it can't be morally required to do the one but not the other, nor can it be morally permissible to do the one but not the other. The permissibility status has to be the same. Aggregation says that for any gain or loss in welfare that may befall any person, no matter how large, any moral requirement to bring about that gain or loss can be overridden by some number of very small gains or losses in welfare spread across many persons that another act one might do might bring about. For non-consequentialist views, aggregation will say that any moral constraint that tells one not to do some act that would wrongfully harm another can be overridden if doing some act that violates the constraint would bring about a large enough welfare gain for others, even if the welfare gain consists in very small boosts spread across a very large number of persons. The standard example is making chairs slightly more comfortable, but you can't notice it, but for lots and lots of people. Morality has multi-level structure, just in case morality prescribes lower level norms and rules that are instrumental to bringing about conformity with at least some component of the fundamental moral principles. The lower level norms are guides to identifying what will better fulfill the higher level norms. The lower level norms provide reasons for action only as derivative and instrumental in this way, so they just have derived normativity. This structure is at least hinted at in writings by John Stuart Mill and clearly articulated in writings by Peter Railton and Richard Hare before most of you were born. These writings were developing consequentialist views, but a non-consequentialist deontology might prescribe, I think should prescribe, a similar multi-level structure. The fundamental deontological truth about, for example, truth-telling or property ownership might be very complicated, so we need legal rules, social norms, a public moral norm, what we announce in the courthouse steps, that assert simple rules that will steer us closer to what the fundamental level norms dictate. Humans being, this is just repeating this standard view here, humans being variously selfish, not well-informed, not very good at reasoning about what to do given available relevant information, will do better at conforming to fundamental norms if given the subordinate rule guidance. For these low-level norms to do their instrumental work, they have to be internalized, we have to accept them, develop allegiance to them, we have to be motivated to comply, and this motivation will persist in decision problems in which the instrumental rationales for following the rules have petered out, so there's really no reason to follow them. Why accept weak welfareism? I admit it's not a stirring claim. We're very unlikely to march under its banner. I don't even recommend that. I hope it has the homely virtue of truth, and here I just hope to present it in an attractive light. The background picture here is that what morality seeks is fair resolution of conflicts of interest among persons. This is just built into the concept. Welfareism says the measure of people's condition for purposes of determining fair resolution is their welfare or well-being. So here's a statement of the position in its consequentialist version. Outcomes are morally good to the extent that they incorporate fair distribution of good period. Good period is always good for some individual or individuals. Outcomes are morally good to the extent that they incorporate fair distribution of good for some individuals or individuals. So the claim by two is not that nothing can be good in itself except individual welfare. There are standards of merit for many types of activity and thing. There are standards of beauty for artworks and sunsets. A good assassin is one that scores high on an appropriately weighted combination of traits that contribute to successful assassination. The claim is simply that only good period that contributes to making states of affairs morally better or worse is what's good for more fairly distributed. Weak welfareism needs defense along two fronts. True welfare, such as Roger Crisp, will find the doctrine too weak, insufficiently welfareist, too diluted. Along this front, the best reply, I think, is just simply to affirm that if, maybe a big if, the empirical facts allow that someone can be morally responsible for the orientation of her will, then it's fair to hold that those who try to orient their will toward the right and the good thereby become morally deserving and as such especially apt beneficiaries of well-being increases. It's a further question whether morally cost-effective policies can be devised that will bring it about that the deserving tend to fare better than the non-deserving. Maybe yes, maybe no. If the answer is yes, then actions and policies should follow this path. Along a more battle-scarred front, the main questions are, one, whether beneficence is a main or sole component of justice principles, and two, whether beneficence has as its aim individual well-being, welfare, fairly distributed. So one is really just an assumption for our purposes. We're just reasoning from it, not to it. This presentation explores two a bit. Also, for the non-consequentialist versions, I fret, a further contested issue is whether violations of moral constraints must involve wrongful harming or wrongful failing to benefit, or now we've got to add wrongful corruption of character. Is welfare a big deal, morally speaking? So just three critics, Casper, Lippert, Rasmussen. So you might take the line, for social justice purposes, the measure of people's condition should not be their resources or liberties or opportunities, rather their what they reasonably ultimately care about, which is their welfare outcomes. Not taking welfare to be the distribuendum of distributed justice would be fetishistic. And now Casper says, surely there are things that people ultimately care about beyond their well-being. So discussing this issue, what's the most plausible form of egalitarianism? Casper proposes that, quote, what people should be equal in terms of is that which they care about non-instrumentally and not unreasonably so. And his proposal will generalize to non-egalitarian views. Sounds attractively ecumenical, but merits rejection. So just very simply, suppose two children are arguing about how to divide a pile of found candy to which none has ownership claims. Asked what each ultimately cares about, the boy reports he wants most of the candy for himself, with less but enough going to other claimants. The other child reports she wants, above all, a fair division in which each gets half of the candy. That's what I care about. So if you interpret fair division as it one that seeks to fulfill to the same degree people's ultimate reasonable concerns, we're going to be led to endorse in this example what intuitively is an unfair division. People's ultimate concerns are heterogeneous. Give to each a fair share of what each ultimately cares about, then it's not going to be a plausible fundamental social justice norm. Suppose some ultimately seek fair divisions across humans and some ultimately seek, in addition, to save the whales or save the Grand Canyon, right? So my response, if whale welfare matters morally, then we should cater to it for the sake of the whales. So we should be fairly dividing wealth among persons, and then the whales enter all as well. If saving the Grand Canyon will do no good for sentient beings ever, the welfarist has to draw a line in the sand and say such concerns play no role in the determination of what should be done. Scanlon. Scanlon has argued that the idea of individual well-being plays no fundamental role in ethics. He takes it to be commonly believed that there's a single notion of well-being that plays three roles in practical reasoning. Here I'm just rehearsing. First, it determines what an individual should do insofar as she's striving to be prudent when choosing in context when no one else's interests are relevant. Second, the notion is what a concerned benefactor has reason to promote. Third, the idea of a person's welfare determines how the person's interest should register in moral argument that determines what we morally ought to do. And more, furthermore, the common idea of individual welfare has to admit of quantitative comparison, at least roughly. So weak welfareism, or I don't know what we call it now, weak welfareism, agrees with these claims, so is targeted by Scanlon's skepticism. He doubts we have any such notion of welfare ready to hand, and anyway we'd have no use for such a notion. He invites us to consider examples in which a parent is called on to make a sacrifice in order to provide special education for her child. If individual well-being were pivotal for determining what to do, the advisability of the parent's action must depend in part on the extent to which the child would benefit from the specialized education compared to the cost to the parent. So where does my interest leave off? Where does the child's begin? But we don't need that at all. All one needs to know is that there's good and sufficient reason to provide the needed education. Sorting out who benefits and how much, that would be an irrelevant exercise. So we just don't need the notion. So in reply, there are cases and cases. Often reasonable judgments about what to do depend on whose welfare would be set back, who's advanced, and how much. We distinguish between a spouse's virtuous devotion to her family and self-abnegating vice. The latter involves seeking tiny gains for family members at large cost to oneself. The friend who demands that you sacrifice a lot so he can gain a little and is oblivious of the magnitude of the side effect gains and losses falling on others, that person is advancing incorrect judgments about what one ought to do. Of course, appropriate personal relations to others require one not to be continuously totting up gains and losses and keeping as precise a running total as one can, but this is fully consistent with being disposed to notice and react to gross discrepancies. A non-consequentialist may hold that a person is not always required to be maximizing any function of overall benefit, so is permitted to make larger sacrifices of his well-being to gain smaller benefits for others up to a point. But the last four words of this formulation will be crucial, up to a point. Scanlon's dismissal of the moral importance of well-being is facilitated by what I take to be a skewed understanding of what it is. He suggests a component of well-being consists in experiential goods such as pleasure. With this, we should concur. He adds that, quoting now, well-being depends to a large part on a person's degree of success in achieving his or her main aims in life, provided these are worth pursuing. But this proposal blurs the line between at least two different sorts of rational aims, moral and prudential. One might rationally choose self-sacrificing aims and make them central to one's life. Making them central does not eliminate their self-sacrificing character. A life aim can be rational because the ratio of good for others to harm to self is sufficiently favorable and self-sacrificing because it lowers, not raises, one's own well-being. Scanlon holds that moral judgments regarding what we owe to one another do properly seek to balance people's interests fairly when they conflict, but the notions of individual interest that should figure in these social justice judgments are morally constrained and conditioned. He opposes the idea that there's a notion of individual well-being, not itself shaped by moral considerations, that's a key input into the determination of what we ought to do, all things considered, and what policies and practices we should endorse. He cites as illustrative John Rawls' idea of social primary goods holdings, as well as Amartya Sen's proposal that justice involves fair shares of capabilities for individuals. So I just think there's rock bottom disagreement here. A welfarist conception of social justice is going to require us to look beyond the means and rights and opportunities available to individuals to gauge the outcomes for the quality of their lives that ensue. And if that wasn't the case, if fundamental principles were requiring us to bring about fair resource opportunity provision or took opportunity to resource provision to be in itself morally valuable, the obligation to secure opportunities for another at cost to oneself should survive the recognition that even if you know for sure that the providing the resources will be wasted, will do no good whatsoever for oneself, for this person or for others. But I think in this case where the you know for sure the resource provision will do no good for anybody, that the obligation to provide the resource just extinguishes. So again, we have to to see what obligations we have. We need to be looking beyond the provision, the balance of opportunities, to see what happens to them, what ensues. This stance, of course, this allows that in a multi-level theory, consequentialist or non-consequentialist, there may be a level of subordinate norms that are insensitive to individual welfare outcomes. This will be so when upholding such norms will be functional for advancing fair shares of individual well-being over the long run. To get the rock bottom disagreement in focus, we'll need to focus on cases in which you could adopt one set of policies and then will clearly bring about fair outcomes in welfare's terms. And by adopting instead a different set of policies, we'll bring about fair shares defined in terms of primary goods, resources, capabilities, opportunities, and so on, whatever the option is. This framing of the issue supposes that individual welfare is a coherent, freestanding, non-moral notion. Some deny this. Ronald Dworkin writes that once a human life has begun, it's of great and objective importance that it be successful rather than wasted, and this is of equal importance in the case of each human life. But the welfarist here is going to a life can be successful in at least two quite different ways, as morally admirable or as high in well-being. Dworkin's not oblivious of this distinction. He clearly thinks it's either bogus or isn't important. He thinks that moral considerations and more narrowly self-interested reasons are interwoven and inseparable in any reasonable individual's notion of success in life or how to live. But consider a person who throws herself on a grenade tossed into a crowded room when she could instead have ducked and lived. Her conduct is morally admirable but not prudent. You could set up the example so that it's morally required but not prudent. A life can consist of many such episodes and be successful in moral virtue terms, but not in prudential terms. They're just two independent streams of reasons here. They can be balanced, but they don't really fuse or mush together. So the welfarist claims. So the third critic is Sen. He urges that moral right, this is an old article. I'm an old guy. It seems like yesterday. Moral rights matter in themselves. The fulfillment of an individual's right is itself a good outcome of an action that brings about this fulfillment. Hence, any version of welfarist consequentialism is incorrect. Sen adds that rights fulfillment partly determines what's right and wrong to do by way of being an outcome to be promoted. This claim opposes views such as those of Nozick, who holds that rights are determiners of what it's right and wrong to do only as side constraints to be respected. So he develops an elaborate counterexample, and since welfarist consequentialism is affirmed as universally and necessarily true, you get one good counterexample that will refute the doctrine. I'm on board with that. The story concerns the decision problem of Donna, a friend of Ali, a shopkeeper in London, who is menaced by a gang of thugs, call them the Bashers. They have planned to waylay Ali this afternoon and beat him up, violating his important right not to be physically assaulted. Donna can prevent this large rights violation only by herself perpetrating a small rights violation, acting against someone's right to privacy. The duty to prevent the large right violation in this situation outweighs the duty not to act against the small right of privacy. This is the verdict Sen expects his readers to affirm. Moreover, in the example, the numbers can easily add up. You can stipulate that they will yield the surprising result that according to all extant welfarist consequentialist positions, fair distribution of welfare overall would be furthered by Donna's allowing, not preventing the bashing, and by the bashers themselves going forward with their beating up Ali rather than refraining from inflicting the beating on them. Yet the bashing remains wrong. The blatant unacceptability of the contrary judgments should convince us to reject the welfarist consequentialism that yields them. That's Sen's view. So in reply, the example contains features that color our response, but that under scrutiny don't imply reasons to reject welfarism. The bashers in the example have an evil, sadistic disposition. Their welfare gained from bashing Ali consists in sadistic pleasure. I think a plausible conception of well-being will count sadistic pleasure either as having zero welfare benefit or as hardly any. Of course, if hardly any is not zero, then that might still permit construction of a far-fetched case in which welfarist consequentialism endorses the bashing. But it seems to me we're now in a kind of science fiction world, and you have to carefully describe it if it's going to elicit reliable intuitions testing candidate principles. The bashers in the Sen example, by virtue of having evil sadistic dispositions, appear to be highly undeserving, but then a weak welfarist position will discount somewhat the moral value of the welfare gains that an action would bring about for them. So these points invite a revised version of Sen's example to still make his point. Suppose the bashers can gain a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to attend an excellent opera performance, but only if they forcibly take the tickets away from prosperous Ali. Forcibly extracting the tickets in the gentlest way regrettably brings about harm to Ali, equivalent to a bashing, but in the revised example, the well-being the bashers get is deserved and large, and the moral disvalue Ali's harm is reduced a bit by slight negative deservingness on his part, stemming from his stinginess and decline to give away the tickets to the poor lads. So you might still insist, so the welfarist, and then in the revised example, just say the bashing should go forward, Donna should not intervene. One might insist that the revised example still involves the violation of a significant moral right not to be bashed, and that's a big deal. But then the first point here is that on a multi-level, weak welfarist consequentialist view, for familiar reasons, it will likely be desirable that subordinate level social norms against bashing, laws against criminal assault and robbery, a public morality proclaimed from the courthouse steps that includes right not to be bashed will all be established. So in a society like ours that has such norms and laws in place, if well socialized, will be moved by a disposition to judge that the bashers are acting wrongly and that Donna should intervene, even if according to fundamental moral principles, we should clearly accept that these judgments are mistaken. And the same point will be hold for weak welfarist non-consequentialisms. In the example as Sen presents it, Ali suffers a significant well-being loss via the violation of his right not to be bashed. He is beaten up. But his moral right not to be bashed might suffer violation even if he suffers no such loss. So we can amend the revised version of the example. So Ali at the time of the bashing is en route to submit himself to a dose of punishment therapy, which is a worthless psychiatric treatment that he's voluntarily undergoing. So punishment theory essentially amounts to being bashed, severely physically beaten, and that's it. So knowing this, if Donna prevents the bashing, she prevents the violation of Ali's right not to be bashed, but in welfare terms, Ali will suffer, let's say, exact harm, whether the bashing accrues or not. If he misses his punishment theory appointment, it can't be rescheduled, so it's a once for all. The welfarist verdict that now Ali's moral right not to be bashed has become morally weightless is correct, I submit. Right? So why accept the, so this is an idea that unfortunately we can't sustain, but I love it, so I think some version of this is gonna be correct. Why accept the idea that all wronging is wrongful harming or wrongful failure to benefit? Consider deathbed lie. My father is at death's door. I'm at his bedside. He asks, have I been a good father? He has not. Assume this is a serious question on his part. He really wants to know. He's not simply looking for feel-good reassurance, but providing slight feel-good reassurance is the best I can do for him now. Notice this is not a situation which the stakes are high, and there's a great benefit that telling a lie will produce. My father will not be getting a large benefit, at most a kind of marginal one. So if one holds that the right action here is that I should tell the reassuring lie to my father, this cannot be interpreted as an instance of a significant wrong, the harmless lie, overbalanced in this case by very large offsetting benefits. If it's permissible to tell the lie, this must be on the basis that the lie is harmless. So just a slight benefit accruing from it suffices to justify it. If one agrees with this, as one should, one has reason to accept that all wrongdoing is wrongful harming, with the qualifications already noted. No welfare loss here, no wrong. I love this idea. Unfortunately, we can't sustain it, just for obvious reasons. I'm about out of time. In many cases of wrongful lies and wrongful broken promises, there's insignificant indirect harm to others via diffuse weakening of the atmosphere of mutual trust. We have to take account of that. Bernard Williams once poured scorn on the tendency to make too much of such indirect effects, sneering at the standard fantasy that one of the effects of one's telling a particular lie is to weaken the disposition of the world at large to tell the truth. Mill's instinct, I think, on this issue is better, though he lapses into hyperbole in expressing it. This is Mill now. inasmuch as any even unintentional deviation from truth does that much towards weakening the trustworthiness of human assertion, we feel that the violation for present advantage of a rule of such transcendent expediency is not expedient. That sort of goes too far, but it's in the ballpark. The welfarist deontologist, to leave consequences aside, will hold that some harmings of people are wrongful and are generally impermissible, even if, for example, telling the lie would all things considered be utility maximizing. When indirect effects are in play, the basis of the obligation is the principle of fair play. Others are cooperating at cost to themselves to sustain valuable conventions. Failing to do one's part by acting in ways that tend to degrade the schemes is wrongful harming of some of the cooperators, those who are in the network and affected. So again, I want to hang on to something like this, but nonetheless, even if it's possible that some restricted version of the claim that wronging must involve wrongful harming can be identified and defended, still, as an across-the-board claim, it can't be sustained, not for any subtle reason, but just it just stares you in the face, just obviously. At least it can't be sustained if one accepts moral options and if one holds that being morally at liberty to act as one chooses up to a point, even if one does not thereby bring about the best reachable outcome. You wouldn't have to go for it, but it seems to me it's very plausible to say that's going to be accompanied by a claim right against others if they not interfere in certain ways. And then just given that, you can't accept the what I'm calling the ancillary claim. Suppose Tom is exercising his right to live as he chooses by taking a vacation in August in Fresno. He's not doing what would bring about the best outcome he could achieve, but he's morally at liberty not always to doing what would bring about the best. This is just the idea of having moral options. Suppose Fresno was a bad spot for a vacation in August for Tom. Someone could interfere with his liberty to vacation as he chooses in ways that would intuitively count as wrongful interference without lowering his welfare at all. But then there are moral constraints, violating which is wrong, even if the violation lowers no one's welfare and deprives no one of any welfare gain. So what we call the ancillary weak welfare claim must obviously be false, that justice, fundamental morality principles, if they ought to assume a non-consequentialist form, will incorporate as moral constraints only constraints against wrongful harming and wrongful failure to benefit. I think something in that ballpark is right, but what? So I'll stop. The question also arises whether narrow beneficence, the duty to bring about good lives for people with good fairly distributed, might be accompanied and maybe completely overshadowed by a wide beneficence requirement, a duty to improve the world that counts fulfillment of moral constraints, for example, and as elements of world improvement. So weak welfareism in its consequentialist guise, I think, has survived counter-arguments, at least the ones considered here. The non-consequentialist version is maybe under threat. The ancillary claim must be given up. The no-difference stipulation has got to be amended as well. The idea that beneficence requirements consist entirely in narrow beneficence maybe is starting to look shaky. I think I can support it by reflective equilibrium methods, but that would be a further story. The worry is that pulling on these threads will unravel further twine claims that weak welfareism and its non-consequentialist version presupposes or implies. I think not, but for now that's just a hope, and that's all I've got. That's a step.
There's no Q&A, but there